You know how important it is to ensure that your supplements are genuine, safe, and effective. That's why I partnered with Fullscript, an online dispensing platform that only offers curated professional-grade brands I know and trust, the very same supplements that I prescribe to my patients and take myself. Never counterfeit or expired, always stored and shipped correctly. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to start your free Fullscript account. Buying through Fullscript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA-compliant and offers world-class support. Fullscript also gives you access to my custom targeted supplement protocols that combine the products that I recommend to address specific needs, heart health, immune support, and much more. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to sign up for your free Fullscript account. You'll get access to the supplements and features you need to help you achieve your wellness goals. That's DearHoffmanStore.com. DearHoffmanStore.com.
Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoppe, on a subject that I really find fascinating because in college, I was an anthropology major before I was pre-med. And this book is right in my wheelhouse, and I think it'll be of interest to you. It's called On the Origin of Being, Understanding the Science of Evolution to Enhance Your Quality of Life. We're talking to the co-author, Jenny Powers, who has a PhD in microbiology, immunology. So she knows the science. She also is an athlete, and she is well-suited to help interpret the vast amount of scientific data that explains our evolutionary origins with news we can use for our current lives. So, Jenny, how do we know what our ancestors ate? Because in the book, you actually talk about evidence from teeth, from brains, from kidneys, mm-hmm. from digestive tracts. How did they change to adapt to our modern physiology in the course of evolution? Mm-hmm. And what does that tell us about what we're suited to be consuming?
Yeah, well, as you mentioned in the first part, as the human lineage evolved, our brains got bigger and our guts got smaller, because our guts, our stomach and intestines, those are very metabolically expensive organs. But our brains started becoming more and more metabolically expensive. And so we started shrinking our gut. So our brain, one of the reasons why we started shrinking our gut, so the brain would get more of our energy. And these big brains and smaller guts required us to change how we ate. We needed to eat less fiber, though hunter-gatherers still ate at least 3 to 7 times more fiber than we do these days. Because we needed to be able to, since our guts were shorter, we needed to be able to digest and absorb the food more quickly as it was passing through our intestines. So we also needed to find more complex carbohydrates, like tubers and roots and things like that. Because fruit is a great source of carbohydrates, but not, they're very short acting, quick carbohydrates. We needed to find some complex carbohydrates. Because our brains...
Oh, just 1 second on that. When we talk about complex carbohydrates, you could get a bottle of some cereal, like breakfast cereal, and say it got complex carbohydrates in it. Whole grains are the complex carbohydrates. But it's a whole different ballgame when we're talking about the complex carbohydrates that our ancestors ate. Mm-hmm. There's an Indian tribe whose name was given to the upstate New York, the Adirondack Mountains. Mm-hmm. I've heard that word is Native American for bark eaters. Hmm. Now, here we're talking about some really complex carbohydrates.
Right.
A lot of fiber in that, and right. Totally not a lot of nutritive value, too. So it's kind of hard to put on a big waistline by chewing tree bark.
This is true. Because it's important to know that our brains only utilize glucose as an energy source. Our brains and our red blood cells. So we needed to make sure that our brains were provided glucose on a continuous basis. But at the same time, we also needed, because our bodies were changing and our brains were getting bigger, we needed to have very high quality fat and protein. that we could absorb quickly and utilize right away, and not have to actually synthesize a lot of things inside of our bodies, which is metabolically costly. And so when we started eating more animal products, animal products have very high quality fat and protein. They've gotten all the any kind of toxin out of it. It's already built in the structure that we'll use it. And so our gut's getting smaller. We needed to be able to digest things faster. Our brain's getting bigger. We needed to be able to give raw material for making our neurons. We needed to get more glucose to get to our brains so we could actually use our brains to solve all of our problems. We kind of went from, at least when we were in the trees, more of a plant-based diet to more of an omnivorous diet. Mm-hmm. And I like to think that, everyone knows primates, some primates are omnivorous, but then they don't understand that we are too. That we are either, somehow it skipped us or we've evolved beyond that. But really, when we were evolving in our natural habitat, those are the foods that we needed to eat.
Indeed. And so you actually mentioned anti-nutrients and toxins in your book. And this is an interesting notion because there's some people like Dr. Gundry with the Plant Paradox. He said that plants can be potentially our enemies. There are toxins, there are poisonous alkaloids in plants and lectins that may be harmful. So is there an evolutionary lesson that we got away from, chewing on leaves all day long very bitter, natural plants? Mm-hmm. And we still have the capacity to eat, some foliage and some things from the plant kingdom, but maybe getting away from reliance on that.
Yeah, well, I think this is where processing comes in, because a lot of the anti-nutrients that plants have can be deactivated, denatured with different kinds of processing techniques. So soaking, cooking, fermenting.
Yeah.
These are all processing techniques that our ancestors knew about and used so they could utilize plant protein, the plant products, and not have those side effects.
For example, they're toxic if you just have them raw, but through very various methods of food processing, traditional means, they're rendered mm-hmm. into edible foods. So yes.
Yeah. So, and the same with meat. I think, that the picture of people like eating the mammoth with lead dripping down. I mean, I think it was when we were Homo erectus that we started making fire and cooking the meat, mm-hmm. because it was really important, because if we didn't cook the meat, we'd have to chew that meat for such a long time. Yeah. So cooking not only released the nutrients, but also made it easier for us to chew.
Right.
So,
by the way, I actually read recently that one of the end scenarios for early humans was when their teeth wore out. They didn't die of heart disease, but maybe at 35 or 40, after chewing this very challenging diet, their teeth wore out, and they didn't have dentures, tennis.
Right.
And so, it's not you are what you eat, it's you are what you can chew and assimilate. And,
Well, and I think that's why nowadays people have trouble with their orthodontia, because we have wisdom teeth that grow and push our teeth together. And so we've actually evolved to start addressing that problem. But now that we don't eat, our foods do not wear our teeth down the same way. Yeah. We have to get those teeth removed, or else they push all of our teeth together.
Yeah.
But I think the cooking is, the processing made things so much easier to chew and digest, that I don't necessarily think, I hadn't heard of, they're starving because they can't chew food. What's really cool about hunter-gatherers is that, once you reach a certain age and maybe you can't go out and forage, or the rest of the group takes care of you.
Yeah.
And so I feel like, so this is something I wanted to say at the beginning, but I forgot. So this is actually a series of three books. So this first book on the origin of being goes over kind of more of our basic needs, sleep, nutrition, work, nature. The next book in this series is going to talk a lot more about social groups, child rearing, the sexes, kind of more social, our social needs as human beings. And then the final book
for those, how we're naturally, our natural inclinations and how maybe modern life is at odds with those.
Oh yeah. The loneliness epidemic is just totally right front and center on that one. The last book is going to be more the arts, you know, how do the arts develop? How did religion develop? What's the significance of rituals and how is it important to society? So those are more like our cultural needs. And so, you know, we're hoping with this series of books, we can kind of build on people's knowledge of how we evolved and kind of get a little bit more complex with our topics.
So it's coming back to the paleo diet. You know, the paleo diet is kind of in the eye of the beholder. And some people who are advocates of the paleo diet say, I mean, there are many different interpretations of it. Some people say no grains. Why? Because grains only evolved with the advent of the agricultural revolution. But surely hunter-gatherers, maybe they gathered, you know, grasses and they took the seeds of the grasses and in effect they were eating grains, but they were very whole grains. They weren't domesticated or processed. Mm-hmm. Then there's the issue of legumes. Well, legumes are, you know, you find them in the wild, but then, you know, we raised them, domesticated them and, you know, made them into, you know, chili con carne. Then there's the issue of dairy, which is kind of unnatural because we know that, you know, humans, you know, subsisted on breast milk, sometimes up to the age of 3, 4, 5, you know, primitive, shall we say, that's not a PC word, in Paleolithic times. But it's unnatural, this notion that a Stone Age man would run after a female antelope and tackle her and suckle from her teats. That is so unnatural, right?
I don't think that ever happened. But something was very interesting, though, is very early in the agricultural revolution, some people's bodies started to adapt through epigenetics. So normally the lactase gene that can digest the lactose in milk gets turned off. But in some humans, it stays on. And so we actually maintain, some people, this isn't everybody, some people maintain the ability to digest milk and dairy, and it doesn't like cause issues with their body.
Yeah, and it happened in different parts of the world. It happened in, you know, in Europe, in more Nordic countries. Also happened in Africa, among the Maasai, I think, you know, certain tribes of Africa. So it's not just a black
guy,
you know, Asian, in parts of Asia that are the northern parts of Asia, Mongolia, they were herders and they have the ability to die. So it seemed to have evolved simultaneously, which is nature's marvelous way of making a very good source of nutrition accessible to adult humans. So in a sense, it is a natural, but it kind of depends on your ancestry, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the only ways, you know, how much our diet changed dramatically and our ability to digest dairy, or a lot of people's ability to digest dairy, is one of the only examples of us adapting genetically to have a new food source.
Within actual fairly recent time, you know, we're
fairly
talking,
recent
talking
time.
Millions of years ago. They think it may have happened, I don't know, 15, 20,000 years ago or, you know, more recently even. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about our way of eating, which is, you know, three meals per day. You know, got to have the three squares, you know, sometimes with snacks, you know, a little bedtime snack too. Versus the way that our ancestors ate, which was there were times of plenty and it was seasonal to some extent. And there were times of famine and it depended on, you know, whether there was game or whether there was a drought. Fasting was kind of part of life. You mentioned that the brain really depends on glucose, but the brain actually has a backup system. In conditions of starvation, the brain can use ketones. It can actually go on, you know, on a fat, fat-based energetic. So that's the basis of the ketogenic diet. So there is actually a backup system that is available to the brain. But what about our way of eating? Is that, you know, undermining us? Because it's, which you know, food is ubiquitous and available 24/7.
Well, yeah, I think that what's a big difference, and maybe all of these ways of being, is that hunter-gatherers, it was in their best interest, in their survival interest, to know what their body needed. If they were hungry, they would find food, but it wasn't morning, noon, and night. If they weren't hungry, they wouldn't eat. You know, and the foods that they ate didn't reinforce our brains, like dopaminergic system, and you know the addiction kind of thing, the way that sugar does. They didn't eat foods that made them crave certain things or make them overeat certain things. It was evolutionary.
Sugar was virtually unknown. I think honey was occasionally a source of sugar, but boy, you had to work hard to, you know, fight off all the bee stings, or you know, maybe climb up a cliff or a tree to get that honey. I mean, we had to drive to acquire calories, and you know, honey's an excellent source of calories. So we have a built-in sweet tooth. But
exactly, and when we find sweet things as hunter-gatherers, we would eat because we didn't know when we would find that again.
Yeah.
So this is a really cool story. So the Hadza in Tanzania, they have a symbiotic relationship with these birds. They're called honey guide birds, and it's one of the only bird-human partnerships, the symbiotic kind of relationship between humans and birds. And so the birds, like the Hadza will whistle to them, and the birds will come, and then the birds will lead them to hives. But they know once they have the humans go to the hives and take down the hives and harvest the honey, they leave some for the honey guide birds. So the birds know if they direct humans to the honey, they will get some honey. And so I that was just one of those stories that I just thought was amazing.
Mm-hmm. So you also talk about, you know, these days we eat meat, and even, you know, the natural grass-fed meat, you know, of the highest quality is simply muscle meat. Americans don't like organ meat. Americans are not what we call nose-to-tail eaters, but most Paleolithic cultures, and even parts of the world now,
they're
really nose-to-tail. They utilize the entire animal. I mean, I think Native Americans in North America were an example of that, is the way that they utilize the buffalo, you know, every part. And, you know, I just thought of this. We acquired for Intelligent Medicine recently a collagen sponsor. So people are, you know, purchasing a nutritional supplement of collagen, but in effect, they're putting back what they're not getting from their diet, you know, naturally.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, I think that's really funny because a lot of things like that, you know, they fortify bread and they fortify milk with things that we've taken out of our diet. They're putting it back in. But in terms of our, I lost my train of thought.
Talking collagen in terms
of... Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so our connective, you know, whenever, I would eat like a piece of chicken, and when I would get a grisly piece of like tendon or cartilage or something, I'd be like, and I wouldn't eat it.
Yeah.
But you're right, you're taking out the collagen, and now there's collagen supplements. Lots of people are getting into bone broth, and so they're learning that while, you know, we can make proteins in our bodies from other proteins, it's really beneficial to our joints if we can consume collagen in its natural state.
Also, there's a lot of evidence from animal remains that our ancestors cracked open bones to access the highly nutritious marrow. And this is something that we rarely do anymore. You know, we can throw the bones away, or maybe we give them to our pets if they're not too potentially dangerous, choking hazard.
And our organs, our livers, brains, kidneys, all of these organs that aren't muscle meat have so many other micronutrients that we need, you know, iron and, you know, vitamins and minerals.
Purines for RNA and something, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I don't know how that's going to make a comeback. Organ meat and collagen is going to make a comeback, but maybe Americans will have to just go the supplement route to get those things in there.
And just to explain, the muscle meat seems like the ideal protein, but it's actually the ideal protein for muscle because it's a blend of amino acids and nutrients is very targeted to supportive muscles. But it lacks the nutrients that are sometimes present in, virtually has no collagen. And to explain the importance of collagen for connective tissue.
Our connective tissue is pretty much made of collagen. It's one of the most abundant proteins in our body.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, being able to support our bodies with ingested collagen rather than having to, you know, produce it in vitro or in vivo, you know, having to synthesize it ourselves. I mean, that's a huge energy savings. And just having that abundant availability of collagen got to help with lots of different...
For our hair, for our bones, for
our
skin.
Tendons.
And so tendons and so on. And so...
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess the take-home message is that humans have the capacity to be omnivorous, to harness a wide variety of nutrients. Mm-hmm. Your contention is it's more important to not what to eat, but what not to eat. So what, you know, in a brief summary, what not to eat?
Yeah, yeah. First of all, our hunter-gatherers never ate artificial sweeteners, artificial colors, artificial flavors, trans fat. You know, our bodies do not know how to digest these things. And so we're still looking to see what kinds of side effects these artificial foods have in our bodies. They also never ate these ultra processed foods. They ate whole food. They didn't eat food products made from isolated carb, protein, fat, smushed together. Mm. You know, they ate the whole food. So I think we were talking earlier about the diet wars.
Yeah.
I think every one of those diet gurus would agree that those are the things that we shouldn't eat, or we should decrease greatly how much we eat, because it's really hard to be the fish swimming against the current. You know, you go to the grocery store and 90% of what's there would be classified don't eat.
Yeah.
So finding some place where you can get your nutritious whole food is difficult sometimes and more expensive. So it's really, you know, it's an individual problem, but it also needs to become, you know, our society's problem. From the top down, we need to start monitoring and making healthy food more affordable.
Right.
And abundant for people.
In fact, that was actually the subject. Before I jumped on with you, there was a congressional hearing under the leadership of Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, which, you know, brought experts together, including RFK Jr. The Callies, Casey, and obviously Casey and Kelly means who were advocating for, you know, a sea change in our food environment, in our health environment. Because we actually have a toxic food environment. We also have a toxic environmental situation where we're assaulted by chemicals. So let's switch gears and talk a little bit about, you know, some of the other parts of the book, because the book is not just monolithically about what to eat. You actually have a very substantial chapter on sleep. You talk about our relationship to nature and the outdoors. You talk about exercise. Can we briefly touch upon those?
Sure. Yeah. So I feel like the easiest way to kind of talk about sleep in a nutshell is that when we were hunter-gatherers, we were not isolated from anything in nature. We were not isolated from the temperature. We weren't isolated from the light. We weren't isolated, you know, from the changes in season. And so what's different between now and back then is their circadian rhythms were entrained by the sunlight to reset every morning. And so they were very, very entrained, meaning in sync with their natural environment. And so now, you know, we wake up and the first thing we do, you know, we get on our phones. We never go outside and we never get the full effect of the sun in the mornings. And then when the sun goes down, we have this twilight existence. You know, the blue light, which is especially, we're most sensitive to the blue light, in light that disrupts our circadian rhythms. So in the mornings, we don't get enough sunlight. And in the evenings, we get too much light. So we kind of live this twilight existence rather than having this spike of light, and then it kind of decreases down.
Mm-hmm.
At night, we used to only have firelight and moonlight. And I think because modern humans are not entrained the way that hunter-gatherers were, even though we have similar sleep times, you know, our hunter-gatherer ancestors did not sleep for 10 hours a day. You know, they would go to sleep a few hours after sunset, and they would wake up at the same time every day. They'd get light, bright light exposure in the mornings, and then at night they wouldn't have bright light exposure. So they were really entrained into their circadian rhythms. And I think circadian rhythms are one of the main reasons why we have such a bad sleep, insomnia, sleep disorders in the modern world.
Which obviously are associated with metabolic problems, because just a few nights of sleep deprivation can cause your blood sugar to rise.
And all connected.
We're also shielded from thermic stress. Mm-hmm. And I found interesting in your book the fact that one of the reasons that it's hard to get fat when you're a Paleolithic person is because at times about 30% of your caloric expenditure is just fighting off the cold.
Shivering. Yep, shivering. It spends a lot of energy to shiver your body that way.
Indeed. And then there's exercise. Now, this is I've read, it's kind of interesting paradox, is that studies show that in hunter-gatherer tribes, you know, they're not out there, you know, jogging all day long. They relax a lot.
They do.
Just like we do. They enjoy relaxing. It's just that the activities of daily living provide them with enough calorie burn-off and muscle conditioning to sustain a higher level of health.
Walked. Sometimes they ran. They dug. They carried. They threw. They squatted. You know, they built things.
So it's just movement. It's not just
movement.
Knocking up a few bench presses. You know, in the gym.
Right. When we go to the gym or when we go jogging, we are trying to imitate. Mm-hmm. Just we try to get in 1 hour a whole day's worth of movement.
Right.
We have not evolved to sit in a chair.
Now we go to our jobs and we
sit in a chair.
Yeah, which is not very physiologic, and just the act of sitting. In Paleolithic societies, did they have chairs?
They
squatted.
They just squatted. Yeah. But also, so they love their leisure time, but they also move their body. They danced a lot. Their leisure time incorporated a lot of movement as well. Hunter-gatherers, based on studies of modern groups, work is something that's kind of difficult to preserve in the archaeological record. But based on modern groups that survived, they really only spend 12 to 19 hours a week on like their food eating activities.
Mm-hmm.
And they did not care about the accumulation of wealth.
Right.
You know, they lived in the present moment. They had an immediate return economy where whatever they harvested, they either ate it or they shared it and it was gone. So they had a very different way of approaching work. And they had a lot of free time. A lot of time to tell stories and to, you know, teach the next generation about all the plants, about the hunting, about the stories, about, you know, the seasons. Everything was passed down as an oral tradition.
Right.
And so we just live in this very fast-paced world where working 80 hours a week is celebrated. And, you know, having burnout is very common. And it's something else that we did not evolve to work that hard, to be focused on one thing solidly all day long in a chair.
Exactly. And then, you know, finally, there's a modern, a relatively recent evolutionary adaptation is the advent of grandparents, which is kind of paradoxical from a natural selection standpoint, because once you've reproduced, your purpose is over in nature. Like, why bother to live 20, 30 years beyond your reproductive age? And the thought is that this is an integral part of the way that humans evolved, is to have the village elder, the grandparents that might free the parents for, you know, productive activities, and impart wisdom to the grandchildren. That there's an evolutionary value to that. And many other species don't have that. They reproduce and then they die.
Right. Yeah, the grandparents, you know, in one, you know, group, they would have three or four generations all living together, working together, doing childcare together, sharing everything that they got. And we go into this a lot more in the next book. You know, most nomadic hunter-gatherer, small nomadic hunter-gatherer tribes were very equal. You know, there was not a hierarchy. It was very, I can't think of the word at the moment.
Egalitarian or?
Thank you. Yes, egalitarian.
Okay.
And so that also applied to age. Like, there wasn't ageism. Every age was valued by what that particular person could bring at their age to the wellness of the entire group. So it was all about survival, and it was all about what people could do to help with the whole, to help the whole survive. You know, everyone was valued. And so that's kind of a change in our modern society that we address in the next book. We talk about social groups and child rearing, you know, the way that women are expected to stay at home with their kids all by themselves, you know, for the first 5 years. That's not how we evolved.
Mm-hmm.
Mothers had help. You know, in the book, I think there's some tribes where by the time they're 1 year old, like, the child has had 17 different caregivers.
Mm-hmm.
And also with childhood, once they became old enough to kind of hang out with the big kids, they, you know, there were inter-age big groups of kids who
taught each other.
Who taught each other. Yeah, each other. Yeah. Exactly.
So
exactly.
Like, so what you're saying is that the nuclear family is kind of an aberration from an evolutionary standpoint.
It actually is.
You know, what our circuitry is designed for. And so,
yeah, but as we, you know, started farming, we started putting ourselves in houses. I mean, I think even 100 years ago, you know, in one household, there was a lot more multi-generational families. And now our houses are getting bigger, but fewer people live in them.
And we warehouse our elderly and senior homes and convalescent homes and, you know, so on and so on.
Exactly. You know, exactly.
So, yeah. Okay. So there are a lot of lessons to be learned, and it's a very ambitious project, but I'm glad you're taking it on and you explained it beautifully. So, you know, for someone who wants an introduction to what's called evolutionary biology and its implications for what we can do in our modern lives to incorporate some of the benefits of the wisdom of the ancients, on the origin of being, understanding the science of evolution to enhance your quality of life. And the author, Jenny Powers, she's a co-author, along with Luke Kummer. And, you know, good luck in your future books. And, you know, when your next book it comes out, just ping us and, you know, I'll be happy to get you back on to talk a little bit about, you know, some of the other insights that you bring to understanding our social order and our spiritual lives, because
that would be great. Thank you so much for having me on. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Indeed. And are there other resources? Is there a website where people can find more?
So our website is ontheoriginofbeing.com. I am also pretty active over on Instagram @ontheoriginofbeing, and it's sold wherever online retailers sell books, you know, so Amazon, Barnes and Noble. There are a couple of local bookstores that sell it, but it's online retailing.
Great.
You can find it.
And I'll be writing a review for our newsletter. So for our listeners who haven't read the review yet, stand by. If you're a newsletter subscriber, you'll get it in your inbox with more details about it. So great stuff.
Great.
Enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks.
This is near and dear to my heart because as a anthropology major, I live and breathe this stuff. So appreciate very much your work.
Well, we appreciate your work. It seems like your anthropology work has totally informed your medical career.
Indeed it has.
And where you are now. I think it's pretty incredible.
Indeed it has.
More people need to have that same background for sure.
I wasn't sure that there was a connect, but it actually has ultimately influenced my career. And, you know, because number one, it helps me understand human origins, because that's physical mm-hmm. anthropology. You know, what are humans equipped for, and how does mm-hmm. our modern lifestyle go against our genetic inheritance?
Mm-hmm.
And the second part is cultural anthropology, which is cultural relativism. You know, we study cultures in a dispassionate way, and with non-judgmentally, to understand how they coped with different circumstances. And rather than saying, oh, this is just primitive, this is just, you know, hocus pocus, you know, even their healing practices had meaning and potentially relevance to mm-hmm. Modern life, not just as odd curios of the past, but, you know, news we can use for our lives.
Totally.
I totally agree. That. Thanks very much for joining us, Jenny. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.
I want to thank you for listening to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or your favorite podcast app, and get new episodes automatically downloaded every weekday. And please give us a rating and review. It truly helps new people discover Intelligent Medicine. The Intelligent Medicine Podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice, and no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they may have, and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. Finally, please visit drhoffman.com and discover everything Intelligent Medicine has to offer, including frequently updated, unbiased health news, and fully vetted product and supplement recommendations.